would be talking about Helmand Province, which surprisingly we haven't really done a solo episode on Helmand yet. It's kind of important in the grand scheme of the war. We are joined with by Chris DeNoto, who did a little time in Helmand, and he's going to kind of help us walk through Helmand Province through the lens of his time there. And from there, we'll talk about the overarching strategic significance of Helmand and how it pertained to the war in Afghanistan. So, Chris, thanks for joining us. I'm going to
pass it
over to you to introduce yourself, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. This is kind of cool. So I grew up in Connecticut. Pretty much nothing special about me, just your typical, you know, high school screw up. 9/11 happened, and so I kind of thought I was going to go into the military before that. But, you know, when that whole deal happened, I was like, yeah, this is, in fact, there's probably nothing in my life that I've ever been so certain about since then than that decision right there. Like, you know, all the things that I've had to decide, I've always kind of had some reservations about, but probably that move to do something in the military was about as solid as it could have ever been in 2001. And so my dad kind of pled with me to go to college, and the I think the compromise we came to is that I'd go to like a military college. And there was actually this other guy, Brandon Kirch, who introduced me to you guys in the first place, who was a year or two older than me, and he had already gone to that school. So he kind of roped me into this Citadel. I got in, I showed up there, you know, just like a scrawny kid from Connecticut, to the South, to this, like, apparently the school like fired the opening shots of the Civil War. So they just like hazed the bejesus out of me because I was a Yankee to them, and kind of like, you know, cut my teeth there. It was a pretty solidifying experience. I wanted to go into the Navy. And then after about a year of being there, you know, I just like, I saw these MESEPs, these Marine guys that were NCOs that were training to become officers. They were in school with us at this military school. And I was like, you know what? That's what I want to do. I want to be one of those dudes. They just seemed to be like a cut above all the rest. And so I easily switched my contract from the Navy to the Marine Corps. At that point, it was like 2003. They were just looking for dudes with a pulse. And, you know, I did that in my sophomore year. And like basically later that summer, I was doing push-ups on a hot tarmac in Quantico somewhere, doing officer candidate school. I did a thing where it was 6 weeks one summer and then six the other. And so I went through those two things, graduated, accepted my commission. You know, you go to the basic school after that, which is a 6 month, you know, thing that every officer goes through to learn some infantry basics. In the middle of that, my girlfriend, who had been dating for a while, was like, yo, I'm pregnant. So that was the first week I showed up there. I was like, all right, I got to be super focused because I want to get this intel job. And I've got to score high here, not let anything distract me. And then like literally right after the indoc PFT, I get this phone call from my girlfriend at the time, who's like, yeah, I'm pregnant. And I was like, well, is it mine? You know? So, you know,
a military thing to happen, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was already fitting right in, you know? It was funny. Cause like I immediately just asked her to marry me, and I flew her down to Quantico. And in like an hour, we just had a justice of the peace marry us and, you know, some apartment. And we just got all the paperwork done in the courthouse while she was there. And then we went to the Marine Corps birthday ball. So it was like it was basically like as hua as it can get. It was funny because like the justice of the peace, I'll never forget. She goes, man, you guys did a lot better than the last couple that was in here. I had a couple the other day and the guy was on the couch crying. And I go, was it Brandon? And she's like, how did you know that? You know, it was like this other dude in my platoon that I just felt like it was him. And I knew he recently got married. But
I was expecting the Justice of the Peace to say they were surprised, because usually instead of an officer, it's like a lance corporal with a stripper.
Yeah, I instantly enlisted person, credibility, you know.
Yeah, so. That's good. That's good. And that's good. That's like E2 vibe, dude. That's a good E2.
Yeah,
vibe.
Yeah, it was good. I felt like I was vibing right in with the. I'll never forget. I went and I asked the my SBC, the commander of our little platoon there at TB, can I take some time off to go get married 5 months from now on this day? And he's like, no, it's denied. Did you come here to become a Marine officer, or did you come here to get married? You know, and I think that was the real. That was like the. I'll never forget that. I'm like, man, this is what I'm into right now. You know, it was really real. In 2007, obviously you guys remember your SBCs were like Battle of Fallujah veterans. So, you know, you were really you were looking at CNN video of this guy with a bandage over his face, fighting in the streets. And then you'd recognize that guy walking past you and you'd see that scar there. So it was like a hardcore bunch, and I think they did a good job with us, you know, building us. And those guys would be the guys that would eventually the people they were training would be, leading the charge into Marja and you know, other towns and the like in Helmand in time. So I kind of got not the job I wanted. I want to be a ground intel officer. Back then, you just put intel officer down. And they would kind of divvy out what of the four different ones you were going to get. You know, SIGINT, ground. There was a human in guy, but that was always going to be like the best graduate of the school. And then and aviation intelligence, which I was like, man, I hope I don't get aviation intelligence. And so they're like, all right, we're giving you aviation intelligence. So I report to Virginia Beach, which was the best part of that deal, actually. Immediately after graduating there, and just go through this awful 4-month course learning about Soviet surface to air missiles. At that point, my wife has the, our daughter, and I'll never forget. I left Portsmouth Naval Hospital to run back to an air to air missile class. You know, I was just that school was academically challenging, not physically in any way, like the basic school or anything, but, what was weird about the 0207, which was the aviation intel guy, is they didn't have the Marine Corps just didn't really need those dudes that much. You know, at that point, they just needed people to fill these other billets that maybe weren't infantry, you know? And so they were nabbing these dudes up to do these advisor tours. And so I was watching my peers not necessarily go to squadrons and, you know, put concentric circles on a PowerPoint to a bunch of pilots, but really go through a pretty gnarly workup and then go in bed with Iraqi or Afghan troops and fight alongside them. I didn't get that gig initially. I ended up going to a squadron, and I hated it. It was pretty cool. The dudes were cool. It was like being in a fraternity. We just go get drunk and do stupid stuff all the time. It was a real work hard, play hard mentality. I was in a Prowler squadron. They deployed more than any other unit I'd ever seen in the Marine Corps. They had a 1-to-1 cycle. Divorce was through the roof. They'd go out for 6 months, come back for 6 months, and they just fly a ton of missions, jamming IEDs overhead or doing comms denial. You know, not to get on the high side, but generally that's what they were doing. And, they would, I did that for 3 years. I did 2 tours with those guys. I went to Al Asad in 2009. So I got my little Iraq badge, but really I didn't do much out there. And then we came home and we had a very brief time, back in North Carolina. And then we went right back to Afghanistan in 2010. I was in Bagram, and that was at that point I knew I really wanted to be an advisor, because that's what my buddies were doing. And I started learning to speak Dari while I was there. So we were working a lot, but when I wasn't working, I would just hang out with these translators that were living on Bagram, and they would just give me one-on-one lessons. And I got decently proficient, finished that tour. The monitor, which, you know, for people listening who don't know what that is, it's a person that kind of helps you decide like what they kind of make the decision of where you're going next in the Marine Corps. It's like, hey, you know, your 3 years is up. Where do you want to go? And I'm like, ending with the wing, man. I want to go ground. I really want to be in an infantry battalion. So he's like, all right, you're going to have to go through another intel school. So we went back to Virginia Beach for 4 months. It was awesome. I check into 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines, take over RBE element, because at that point, those dudes are in Marja. They get back. I'm with them for a little while. And what happened was they just decimated that whole battalion because they weren't going to deploy for a while. They just IA'd them. They individually augmented everybody to do different things that they needed. You know, at this point, it's 2012. We're pretty deep into Afghanistan and they just need people. And so they chopped me over to 10th Marine Regiment for a minute, for like a very short period of time. And then I finally got to go on one of those advisor tours that I wanted so badly. I begged the colonel over there to let me go. You know, he's like, I don't, sure. You know, so he signed me up for that. And what began was like the best time in my Marine Corps. I checked into this thing called the ATC, which is Advisor Training Cell on Camp Lejeune. And we went through a pretty long workup and we learned more language training, like tons of Afghan culture training. I don't know how to like perform surgery on a pig, you know, like they would live tissue training. They would just bring in these amazing subject matter experts from Central Intelligence Agency. Like, you know, they're all retired contractors, but, you know, ex CIA Special Activities Division guys, or an adjunct professor of medicine for the live tissue training part, or, you know, an actual medic from SEAL Team 6, you know, a corpsman who had been with like DevGru for like trauma. You know, we'd go out to California, to the desert for like a month at a time and just practice close quarter pistol work, or man, they filled a whole entire mount town up with hundreds of Afghan Americans and just made them role play. If you ever seen like the show Westworld, it was like a Afghanistan Westworld where where you got to do all these different scenarios, and they'd evaluate us. And so our team did really well. They chose 2 of the 4 teams to go get deployed. We were supposed to, at that point, go to this pretty shitty place called Nowzad. But actually, by the time we deployed, they moved us instead to this, the next town over, which was this place called Musakala. So if you don't know where Musakala is, it's like just north of Sangin, which is, you know, pretty notorious, right? Saying everybody's like, oh, yeah, Sangin. And it was just a little bit east of Nowzad, southeast of Nowzad, between Nowzad and Zamindawar. And if you kept walking through the Zamindawar, eventually, you know, you could get out to Kajaki or something like that. But it was the northernmost part of Helmand Province that was held by U.S. forces, or by at least government of Afghanistan forces. If you went any further north, you'd be in Baghlan province, and that was pretty much Taliban held. Nowzad was basically taken back by the Taliban. Zamindawar to our east was taken by the Taliban. That's more or less just kind of desert area. And then really to our south, I guess we were holding on to Sangin by like a hair, but you could pretty much say we were surrounded on all 4 sides. We heloed into a combat outpost, Musakala. It was 2 platoons of infantry on our advisor team. And then, you know, just some State Department folk, USAID guys trying to rebuild things. At that point, the only people really leaving the wire were the advisors to just continue to train, organize, and equip the Afghan police. We were Afghan police advisors. And, you know, that was kind of the beginning of what would be our deployment out there. We would, I wouldn't say necessarily at that point live among the Afghan police, but we would work hand in hand with them every day. They were at that point already uniformed, armed, fairly well established because the advisor teams before us had accomplished that. So our job was really to, you know, observe and give them guidance where necessary.
And can you describe some of like the, sorry.
Yeah. No. I learned really quickly that, you know, there's a big difference between those guys and the role players in California. That's all I was going to say.
Yeah. I would imagine so. And speaking of, can you describe some of the culture, like as far as like the culture within the Afghan police? Because as guys that like, I mean, that was like part of my job is like research the culture and stuff inside the Afghan police and army and everything. And it was just like, it sounds absolutely awful. But for somebody who was actually with it, you know, can you describe a little bit about the culture of the Afghan police?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I'd say about being an advisor and working with those guys is you could like somebody and you could think somebody was proficient at their job or not proficient at their job. But you never truly knew who you really could trust. You know, if somebody had killed lots and lots of Taliban, savagely and without, you know, any, you know, mercy, then I suppose you could know that they could never go back to the Taliban. But the reality is a lot of those guys were a lot of the people we were working with were previously Taliban, you know, like 1990s era Talibs. And that's the number one thing I would say. Like, we always had our sidearms on us, always. Like, maybe we would take our flak, our Kevlar off to, you know, show them that we had solidarity and we trust them, and we'd sit down in their home and have tea with them. But that pistol was always there. And a lot of the training we did it as advisors was quick reaction on that side piece. You know, on that sidearm to react to some type of green on blue incident. We learned that firsthand in June, not long after we got out there.
Again? Can you clarify the year? Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. This is 2013. Fighting season of 2013 in the summer. June 10th kind of sticks out in my mind. I don't know if that's an exact date, but this was definitely like reported in BBC. We had an insider attack where we lost communications with one of our outposts. So the way it was set up was we just held the green area, the area along the Musakala River, and we had put about 50 outposts around the main bazaar, which was in the center of that area. And, you know, I would say this is about the size of, you know, probably like 20 kilometers north, 20 kilometers south, maybe 5 east and west. You know what I mean? Like it's almost like an oval shaped security ring of about 50 outposts. And one of them to our west, Zorioia, we lost contact with in the middle of the night. And what we would do all the time is we would just take the MRAPs out, go on a patrol, mount a patrol, and just check in on these different outposts. And these things, man, they're not much bigger than your house, this outpost. It's just 4 HESCO barriers with maybe 6 to 10 guys inside and a machine gun nest. And they're literally just holding the perimeter of the green zone. We lost communication with one of these said outposts in the middle of the night. We weren't able to establish anything. So about, you know, 05:30, we mount up and start rolling out, and I dismount out of the vehicle. There doesn't seem to be anybody manning the machine gun up on the wall. And I go, I dismount with somebody else. We walk in there and I see 6 dead bodies, or, you know, a pool of blood. There's one body. And then I move around the corner and I see more, and I radio in that we've got a big problem here. and so what had happened after some investigation is we realized that one of the police basically waited till it was his turn on fire watch, called his Taliban compatriots, said, I'm the only one on post right now. You know, I'll let you in. They drove up. He let him in. It looks like they just stood over each of the bodies while they slept and then just emptied a clip into them all and they took the Ford Ranger, they took the all the ammo, they took the their comms gear, and you know, also a Dishka, if I my memory serves me, which is a heavy caliber, basically the equivalent of our M2 50 caliber heavy machine gun, Russian version of that. So you know, you were always reminded, like, they're among you. You know, like, anytime we tried to go on a patrol, the Taliban were already maneuvering and reacting to it. You know, if we did a clearing operation, they were tipped off to it ahead of time. It's very difficult to control OPSEC around those guys.
Yeah, and it's so tough, you know, kind of trying. Anyone who deploys knows that, you know, there's a big push, definitely from higher, but also by the guys on the ground to try to mitigate those green on blues. But, you know, even if you have some squared away, you know, Afghan troops that you're working with, they have families. You know, the Taliban have ways to, you know, get to people, and so that it's really tough to be able to deal with the fact that a guy that you've been working with for, you know, 3 months could just turn on you the next day with no sign or anything.
Yeah, it was definitely something to think about all the time, and it presented some serious challenges. Even just knowing that it was a possibility put some level of a wedge between the advisors and you know, the camaraderie they'd try to establish with the Afghan security forces.
One of the things we talked about a lot is just how corrupt the Afghan police are, especially compared to other agencies, with especially the Afghan local police, which I don't know if you've had experience with the ALP or whatever they were back in 2013. Oh, yeah. Could you describe some of the corruption you saw, if you saw any of it? Because that was one of the big things, one of the absolute big issues in, you know, 2016, 2017 was the corruption.
Yeah, I mean, you know, two examples. I'll give you a small one and a big one. I mean, we would set up a checkpoint and they would just start extorting money from people as they tried to move through the checkpoint, you know, just regular people. And you'd go over there and be like, what are you doing? And, you know, you'd realize they're just taking money and belongings and payment from regular folks trying to move through, you know, a choke point that we would set up our checkpoints at. That was pretty normal to them. It was even difficult to articulate, like, hey, that's wrong and let's not do that. It was almost cultural. You know, another bigger example would be we captured a pretty high level dude, you know, and we rolled this guy up, took him into custody, and the Afghans were like, okay, we're going to hold him. And then we realized who we had, you know, higher kind of let us know, this is who you've got. I think who you think you have is who you have. And we're like, hey, you know, can you bring that guy down here? We'd like to have him in our possession. And the night before, we had heard some chatter, let's just say, that the Taliban were offering a large sum, like 60 million rupees comes to mind. But I would maybe go back to my notes and see if that's true. You know, I might be messing those numbers around. But a large sum of money to have that guy back, and they were considering it. And so when we tried to take him into our custody at our, you know, outpost instead of theirs, there was a bit of a Mexican standoff between the advisors and, you know, these police that we were there working with, because their leadership was saying, no, he's, you know, he's ours. Don't let them take him. And it really took a phone call up to our higher headquarters down through their higher headquarters. And, you know, the chief of police's phone rang. He got the call from his boss, you know, give him to the Americans. And that was it. You know, we put him on the helicopter and that's how we were able to get the guy. So I can't say they were definitely going to sell him, but it looked like they were probably going to sell him. And it wouldn't have surprised me if they sold him. If he was just, you know, oh, we let him go the next day, you know.
I would for sure if I was an ALP.
Yeah, we saw that stuff a lot, and I mean that's AUP. That's not even ALP. So as an advisor, you have to kind of, there's this term, Afghan good enough, that we would be told all the time. Like, is this acceptable for the mission? Like, in accordance with what's acceptable in the Afghan, you know, guise of what they want to do. You know, don't try to match the United States Marine Corps requirement to what we're trying to do right here. And so that was kind of this, the mantra of Afghan good enough. So there's just a certain amount of, you're not going to really fix corruption, you know, at that point. It's permeated throughout the ranks, and our, you know, our directions. I asked the general on right before we got dropped into Musakala, he had breakfast. He called us into, you know, this private room and had breakfast with the officers of this advisor team, which is like 5-6 people. And I asked him, sir, do we have any plans to take back Shagali? Shagali was this city that had just fallen, or this village that had just fallen to the south of RAO. Basically, they had taken back the Taliban had taken back a significant portion of the terrain that we once held. And I asked him, what's the plan to take this back? And he said, I don't think there is any plan to take it back. I'm like, well, then what's our, you know, what exactly is our objectives out here? And he just said, just get them through the fighting season. You know, just get them through the fighting season. And I think that was, you know, that was kind of the morning after, before we're supposed to get dropped in there, hearing him just say that to me, that there wasn't some broader or more aggressive expectation of us, was kind of telling of the situation to come. It's almost like he knew so much more than I didn't already know. And he's like, just don't get killed. You know, this is going to collapse one day. Don't have it fall apart while you're there, and, you know, go on one day and just sell software and have more children, you know? So I've always kind of looked back on that breakfast, and I think about it a lot, you know? And it wasn't a surprise to us 2 years later in 2015 when it fell, because the locals there really seemed to prefer the Taliban in a lot of ways. The Taliban seemed a lot more capable of maneuvering and mounting offensives. And they were just kind of chipping away at this perimeter that was never seemed to be getting replenished with new forces.
It's got to be pretty infuriating, right? When you think back on it now, and I'm sure even then, this is, you know, 2013. So we're not to the end of the war, and we're kind of past the big surge in the middle, which we'll get to in a minute. And the guidance is get them through the fighting season. Well, you know, we've talked about it before in here when we talk about when General McChrystal was in charge of the mission in Afghanistan, and how his goal of retaking Helmand Province, while probably unrealistic, was at least something. I don't recall another commander having a grand plan like that. Like, I'm going to do something big that can potentially turn the tide to a war.
Or even like measurable goals like that. Like that's something you can actually put down and say this.
He just had measurable. Happened. Yeah, there were very few measurable goals. I think like by the time we got there, it was just keep the district centers or keep the provincial centers. Like, nothing else matters, even though 75% of the population doesn't live within the district or provincial capital.
Right.
Right, they live out, you know, 30 miles outside of the Sangin District Center, or 20 miles outside of, you know, Barham Shah.
Yeah, this,
but we didn't
this
care
is exactly
about
that. What that was, by the way. I mean, if I could draw a map of Musakala, it's that oval. It's the area around the river and where farming can happen. And the reason they wanted us to hold it, I suppose, was so we could control the, you know, movement of poppy, which I wasn't always convinced we were doing. You couldn't ignore the fact that, like, Zamindawar, sure, it was a desert, but it's not like nobody lived there. A lot of people lived out there. A lot of people lived out, you know, in Bakalan. A lot of people lived east, west, and north of us, and we were really just holding the district center. And what does that necessarily mean in the grand scheme of things? You know, it reminded me of the early days of the Vietnam War and the hamlets, you know, hitting the different hamlets, you know, throughout the country. If you read some of that history, I'll say that, like, you know, we're talking about physical terrain. One thing in counterinsurgency that matters a lot is the human terrain. And there are just certain kingpins. There's certain key facilitators, players that are absolutely critical. In Musakala, there was this guy who you could easily Google named Wally Coca. Wally Coca was previously a Taliban commander, and he had decided to switch sides, work with the government, and through really since the Marines first arrived there, which was, you know, about 3 or 4 years before 2013 when we're there, he, with the first advisors, built out a really sizable security force, and the bubble, the security bubble, was growing more and more every day. He was very influential. Yeah, I mean, he was definitely using, like, opium money to pay his guys, but he was getting the job done. He had this guy, well, we don't need to talk about him, but Wally Coca, the Taliban recognized that he was a key figure and launched a pretty audacious suicide bombing attack against him, where Taliban hitmen dressed up as police showed up at the ECP in the middle of the district center. You know, when they were challenged by the police there, they opened up on them with silencers on their AKs, so nobody else heard it. They moved past those three or four guards and then moved down this corridor, made their way into the main area where they were all dining. And at that point, the game was up. There was a firefight ensued, and one of them just got close enough to Wally Coca to self-detonate. And they didn't kill Wally Coca, but he was a vegetable. I mean, he had severe brain injury, and he was hospitalized for the rest of the war in India, and more or less just out of the mix. You know, his brother took over. They killed him too. There was just... After that, it was pretty difficult to maintain or establish the same level of security in that area, because they had taken out that critical, you know, that basically center of gravity for that particular district and the human terrain aspect of things.
Yeah, Uruzgan was the same way with the Khans. I mean, there's just certain power players that once that whole power structure is disrupted, it completely destroys the entire I mean, the whole thing collapses. So I'm sure that's probably the way it was there too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible, you know, that they were able to mount, from a tactical sense, operations like that. And, you know, B, just to even kind of step back and assess, like, how are we methodically going to do this? Like, what is the center of gravity that needs to be removed here? And what's the critical vulnerability to exploit to get there, you know? And so I thought it was a pretty respectable enemy in a counterinsurgency sense, you know?
And you know, able to differentiate themselves because they're, while the, you know, Afghan security forces were regionally more like personality based and kind of top heavy in terms of, like, you have a one guy who's in control of an area. The Taliban, you know, they're able to move people between areas, at least commander wise, and their strength is the, like, local fighting force that, you know, operates and lives in the area and then, you know, does whatever they do in the winter and is able to maintain their fighting capabilities even if we capture their commander. And it's something that really vexed us, you know, throughout the war, because, you know, we get the bad guy. Well, you know, the Taliban's basically the Hydra and able to regrow, you know, regrow another mid-level commander, you know, at the drop of a hat.
Absolutely. It was readily apparent to me that they definitely use their farm teams, you know, so to speak, and they absolutely operated with impunity moving through the Pakistani border. It was clear to us that, you know, from an intelligence perspective, at a tactical level, that fighters and munitions were regularly moving up through that border into our AO. And we could actually identify their movement from when the report came to, you know, when maybe we killed or captured one of them and make that traceability occur.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that's when you get to, when you talk about this, the strategic importance of Helmand, and to highlight what Stu's saying, when we talk about next man up, I think Helmand might be like the shining example for the Taliban. It seems like every commander they had in Helmand, especially at the provincial level, was highly competent and highly capable. I know when we were there, it was Haji Manan, right? He was the guy that was in charge in Helmand. And I mean, he was responsible for introducing the Red Units or the Sirikita, whatever you want to call them, like the Taliban, you know, quick reactionary force, as you know, their version of like a shock team or a strike team. And the last like 5 years of the war, you saw huge gains made by the Taliban and Helmand. And a lot of that was because of the framework that Haji Manan had put in place. Like, he was killed later on, but by that point, he and his deputy, who I can't remember, I know their objective names, but I can't remember their real names. They had done so much to create this structure that was, it wasn't foolproof, right? We were able to reach out and touch them, but the Afghan military was pretty much helpless to stop them at the end of the day, right? Helmand has always had good Taliban commanders going back to really like 2006, because, you know, the 4 years from 2002 to 2006, you know, right, we were winning for the most part. I think it would be safe to say we were winning those wars. You didn't see a whole lot of fighting throughout the country except for those four southern provinces, Zabul, Kandahar, Uruzgan, and Helmand. And then Helmand is like where the, like, almost like a quasi resurgence comes from that Barm Shah area that you're talking about, Chris, like that, you know, those border towns where it's so easy to go back and forth and smuggle people and weapons and trainers and money, get opium out, get bullets in, yeah, stuff like that. Barm Shah became highly, highly important. And we didn't really do, when I went back and I was looking at all the different, you know, operations we did in Helmand, and I just don't see a whole lot of shit going down in Barm Shah, where we probably should have had some sort of a task force. We had one in Spin Boldak, right, in Kandahar, which we knew was a big smuggling area across the border, but we just didn't put the same effort into Barm Shah, and it bit us in the ass in the end of the day.
You make a good point, but, you know, I also think there's only so much that we as a coalition could do. And like, I talk about that breakfast with the general and how I asked him if we would go, you know, retake Shagali. Well, the reality is we did go retake Shagali. Like, we used, by the end of my tour, we launched an operation where we used the operational reserve force in conjunction with our advisor team. We landed, you know, CH-53s in the middle of Shagali. And, you know, I had AV-8B Harriers flying around. It was a decent operation. We took the whole area, killed a couple guys, blew up a bunch of motorcycles. Of course, the police were angry that we didn't just take the motorcycles back and give it to them. Found huge weapons caches and, you know, basically turned to the Afghan leadership, Afghan government leadership in Musakala and said, okay, you know, this is yours to have now. You can just go man it and repost up here. And look, we've made this area larger again. And they just didn't do it. You know, we stayed on station there for over 24 hours. They didn't want to send anybody there. They were really butthurt that we didn't tell them about it ahead of time, which, you know, high level leadership decided, hell no, we're not doing that. This is a Marine operation. we can include the Afghans once the operational reserve force has put their foot down off the 53s, but not before that. You know, we need to have the element of surprise on our hands. We're not gonna risk their lives. So the way it worked was the 53s landed, they made the assault. Then the advisors turned to the police and said, "All right, we're going on a, you know, we're going on a road trip down there. We're gonna, you know, go create a cordon to the north." And we went and did that. And then they didn't want to go into that town and create new security there because they were offended that we would do that without talking to them about it. But the reality is, from an operational security standpoint, we had to do that because they absolutely would have known. But that kind of highlights what I'm saying about how much can we really do, you know? If the enemy is that entrenched inside of our ranks already, to the point where we don't have any trust in the OPSEC, to the point where we can't include them in the planning of, you know, important operations like that, to the point where it drives that wedge between their trust and value in us. And then you mix in with that the, you know, Pashtun culture of pride, and not just being able to suck it up and say, okay, that's what's going on. You're right. You couldn't trust us. We'll take that territory. You know, they'd rather just give it to the enemy. And culturally speaking, that's, you know, that's just so Pashtun of them. But it really speaks to the challenges that you have in that type of a counterinsurgency environment. You know, we can do everything we possibly can, but it doesn't mean anything if they're not willing to really just go that extra mile on their own, you know?
Imagine if we had just paid them, or correction, if their government had just
paid them. Yeah. I mean, it really, at the end of the day, it really does come back to lots and lots of issues with corruption.
Did you see a lot of pay issues? That was always an
issue. A lot of ghost soldiers. We definitely saw that, where they wouldn't report. They wouldn't report their casualties and just take the money and, you know, pay themselves with it. You know, there was a lot of that, you know, and look, there were just a lot of really good guys that were, I think, caught up in a fairly impossible situation because so much was happening, you know, in tiers of leadership above them.
I think that gets lost a lot, especially in this podcast. We talk about corruption and everything, and and never have we ever meant that, like, every individual Afghan soldier and Afghan police officer is a corrupt individual. I mean, a lot of those guys are just doing the best they can, man. It's like, it is a shitty situation to be in, regardless.
Yeah, I want to highlight that while I was there, 27 Afghan security forces lost their lives, and they paid the ultimate price, you know. And so I would never want to desecrate their memory by, you know, painting some portrait of just everybody's corrupt and bad. There were definitely people who were doing everything they could to hold that thing together. And, you know, they're not here today to talk about it as a result of that. And so that's also the reality.
Can you tell us about one of them, maybe, that you know of off the top of your head?
Yeah, I mean... I'll tell you what, maybe not one that got killed. I'll tell you a story about somebody who, I'll tell you a pretty sad story. Instead of doing one that died, I'll just do one that was horribly maimed. I'll never forget when we went to that post where those six guys got killed. The commander of, like, that sector, so he wasn't inside that base that night, but he was in charge of that area. His name was Boz, and he was just, like, bawling, losing it. And our team leader, I remember they were both sitting on a crate, and he was, like, hugging him, you know, consoling him, trying to get him under control. And that was like the last time I really remember seeing him before he stepped on an IED. And we told, we knew somebody had planted an IED. We'd seen him on the ISR. Like, there's an IED down there, and he went walking around anyway. I don't know why he did it. And he stepped on the IED, you know, obviously, like, massive hemorrhagic bleeding from his legs. And, you know, we put the tourniquet on him and got him a nine line. Nine line's like the jargon for what you call in to get a medevac out. And, you know, we saved this guy's life. It was amazing. I mean, he was losing blood through his femoral artery. We did everybody did everything right, from the air controller to the, you know, trauma, and got this guy who really should have died out of there. Well, he lost both of his legs. And, you know, so we find out, like, okay, he's back at Leatherneck. The surgeons were able to save him. This guy's alive. And we tell the father, who comes to our combat outpost to get news, that that's the situation. And he's grabbing onto me, and he's pleading and crying and begging me to just let him die, just kill him. Because I've already got my other son, who was a police officer years ago, maimed, and he's unable to work the land. He's unable to work the farms. And I can't get through another wheat season with two sons that are both crippled. How am I going to feed these guys? And please just kill my son. And like, fuck, man. You know what I mean? Like, that shit just crushed me. You know what I mean? Like, to go from like the celebratory feeling of like, we saved this guy's life, to having his own dad like wish that you had not done that. Like, it just crushed my soul, you know? And it's a lot to unpack. I think, to me, it's the epitome of suffering. I think people just, when they think about civil war, which is exactly what it was, we're just a bunch of white kids in the middle of somebody else's civil war. It's hard to articulate like really the suffering that comes with that. And that story, to me, at least begins to scratch the surface of what it is, you know? I don't know how I got like, oh, we were just talking about, you know, one of the people that was killed. I mean, there were a lot, and the reality is a lot of them got killed during Ramadan. They were ambushed during Ramadan. As you know, like, Taliban believe that if if they kill their enemy, us mainly, but hey, we'll settle for ANSAF or AUP, during the holy month of Ramadan, then there's a place for them in paradise. And so I recall there being a heavy amount of casualties during that month, which happened to be in the summer during the fighting season. You know, that's usually a lunar holiday. It kind of moves, I think, about 10 days every year. But in 2013, that was in the summer while we were there.
I don't think anything in the human experience prepares you for stuff like that. I mean, it's just like some new tragedy, some new horror that you're faced with, and there's really no real answer to that. I mean, there's, yeah. What do you say? You know, I thanks for sharing. That's brutal, man.
Yeah. No, this seems like the place that this town, Newtown. I live in Newtown. And so this is where like, there was also a horrible tragedy. And so when we, later on, this guy, Kareem, who's my translator while I was there, gets stuck in Kabul. Make a long story short, we figure out a way to get him out through the gates at HKIA. And he comes and he lives with us here in Newtown. And so the town made a big deal out of it because, you know, they're kind of known for the tragedy. So I think part of this town really wanted to be known for something other than that tragedy. And they had this big thing where they sat us down in the library and, you know, they're like, tell us about some of the events that happened in Afghanistan. You know, it's a bunch of, you know, utopian kind of soccer moms there. I'm like, I don't know if this is exactly the right venue for the Boz story and his dad begging me to let him die. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's good to, I appreciate you guys giving me the venue to tell it.
Yeah, you got to have a venue for those stories, man. I mean, the world needs to hear those stories. That's the Afghan war, man. Like, I mean, you can talk about strategic level decisions all you want to, but that's the true cost of it. So, can you talk to us about, yeah, the extraction? That's what we got you on here, you know, to talk about, really, is extraction.
Yeah, yeah, we forgot about that.
And now we've gone through this, all this horror, and now you can tell us about this new
Yeah, so, you know, one thing that was pretty sad about us leaving there, we actually got pulled out early out of Musicala. I don't know why. It was supposed to be like a 6 month, or actually supposed to be a 9 month deployment. They pull us out of there, I think maybe after like 5 months, maybe shorter than that. And they're like, we just need you to leave really early in the morning and not tell any of the police that you're leaving. So these two CH-53s just roll in, and as we're loading up, I just ran over to one of the leaders and I was like, hey man, I'm sorry. This happened on really short notice, but we're leaving. And this MARSOC team came in and replaced us, which is, you know, like, that's not good. You know, you're not supposed to, like, progress is not being replaced by a MARSOC team. You know what I mean? So that felt shitty to just leave and not really tell them that we were leaving. So we get on the helos, we go home. We took our translators with us. They're part of the team. They didn't live in Musicala. They were contracted from this company called Mission Essential Personnel. I don't even know if it still exists anymore. You guys remember Mission
Essential Personnel? It does. Yeah, it still exists. I don't know.
Oh, it still exists? Okay, cool. Hmm. So, you know, these guys they're Afghan nationals, and they've been told, hey, if you work with Americans for 4 years, we're going to put you through this special immigration visa process. So that ultimately works out for a few of them on our team. One of these guys, his name is Kareem. I don't know, just doesn't work out. You know, I find myself, you know, as a fat businessman years later after the war, like I'm selling software and stopping what I'm doing in the middle of the day to, like, you know, write a letter of recommendation for this guy, because he just keeps getting, having to go through these appeals processes with the chief of mission out of the U.S. Embassy. So I'm watching over the years that the red just get bigger and bigger through Afghanistan, you know, just closing in on the big cities, Mazar-e, Kandahar, Kabul. And you can kind of just smell this thing coming, you know. At some point last year, I got with an immigration attorney who actually specializes in Afghan situations. And I'm like, what do we do here? And she walks me through these different possibilities, and none of them look very good. The best one is, I own a small business here in Connecticut, and we're going to go with this work visa. And with this thing, you know, we're going to put an ad in the paper for this job. We're not going to give anybody else the job if they call me. And it's got to sit there for like a year or something like that. And if, you know, we have to prove like why we need this person from Afghanistan to come here and, you know, deliver paper goods to restaurants. Like, nobody else could do that, you know? So that's kind of the direction it looks like we're going in. And I remember saying to me, that could take, like, best case scenario, that could take a year and a half. And I'm like, I said to her, like, I don't think the embassy is going to be there in a year and a half, you know? And I think a couple months after I said that, the whole thing collapsed. I remember at some point I just wired Kareem $3,000. And I said to him, listen, dude, forget the whole visa thing. Just go at that point, you really couldn't go anywhere other than, like, you couldn't go to Turkey anymore. It's like, just go to the Indian embassy, and I don't care what you have to do with this money, bribe whoever you have to bribe, and get out of that. Just get a visa and go to India. We'll figure it out from there. He was getting night letters. He was getting threats. People had called his phone. They knew he was an interpreter. I don't know, for whatever reason, the Taliban just really doesn't like interpreters. They'll look the other way for like a CID agent or something, but an interpreter, no way. You know, he says, okay, you know, it's going to take 10 days. And then I'll get a visa to India. And 3 days later, the country collapsed. You know, I think it was August 15th. I wake up real early in the morning. I actually had like a nightmare. I woke up at 4 a.m., put on CNN, and I see that Ashraf Ghani is leaving the country and that the Taliban have completely rolled into Kabul. And I go to my WhatsApp. I play an audio message that I see from him. And it's just this just heartbreaking message. You could hear beeping in the background and people screaming. And he's like, I think I have to go home now. They're here. They're coming. I've been left behind. And I realized, you know, the gravity of the situation. The night before that, I had called another interpreter. And I said, hey, man, you know, you're from Kabul. I know you're living in the United States right now in Virginia. I need you to help me get Kareem out. He's stuck. And he's like, I can't help you because I'm stuck here too. I married a woman. I couldn't get her a visa. And I ended up, I just decided to stay here. I'm not going to leave my wife who's pregnant behind. So, you know, at that point, it's incredible how this happened. But like, I just got the advisor team back together again through Facebook. Explain the situation. They weren't really able to help me, but they, between the 20 of us, they knew people who would be useful. And so I brought together in a text thread about six of those people. And we just created this very informal task force called Task Force. Ultimately, we eventually call it Task Force Rambo, which is silly, but there's a story to that. And for the next 2 weeks, we were in constant communication, coordinating with different people that were actually on the ground inside of Hamid Karzai International Airport, and these people that, you know, we identified that needed to get out. So Kareem and the other translator, Hash, were two of them, and of course Hash's wife. And really, we just set out working on the two of them. Hash was easy because he was a U.S. citizen. So he was we were able to just basically communicate to him through this Afghan task force that the State Department had set up when to move out of his apartment. And he and his wife were able to get to the gate and get out. You know, we had tried different things where we tried to get Kareem and Hash together. And I tried to get them inside the airfield before the Americans were able to take it. So on that first night when all that mayhem was happening, I'm like, just go inside of there. U.S. forces, you know, 2-4, the MU is coming along with the 82nd Airborne. Just hide somewhere inside of that airport and stay there for 24, 48 hours. And you'll have a perimeter around you, you know, and then you can just flash your American passport. And by please, for the love of God, take Kareem with you. Like, don't let Kareem not, you know, don't leave him behind. Well, that plan fell apart because, like, they had a seven-month pregnant woman with them. You know, I mean, like, you can't, like, ask a man to have his seven-month pregnant wife stay in a mob for 48 hours while 82nd Airborne soldiers are screaming and shooting in the air for them to leave. So, you know, I did get them together, but they couldn't stay there. And so, to me, it was like a bank robbery where, you know, the hostages make it out of the bank and the police say, like, go back in there. It's too crazy right now. We'll deal with it later. You know? So, that was a tough moment. I wasn't able to get them to link up again. There was just too much mayhem around the airport. And ultimately, you know, the Hash and his wife get out, which is a small victory for us, but we put all of our focus and energy into Kareem. Like 4 or 5 attempts are made. He just keeps getting turned away. And we realize we've got to identify people inside of that airfield that can identify him and get him out. We ultimately do. There's this guy, Tom Schumann. Everybody knows him. He's like in a gazillion CNN interviews and New York Times. He just wrote a book. I saw him on TV and I just looked on LinkedIn at who else knew him with me. You know, the Marine Corps officer community is a small world. So I found this guy, Andy Babos, a good friend of mine, actually. And he gave up his cell, and I just pummeled this dude, this poor guy's cell phone, asking for the contractor that helped him with his translator. Because there was this big news story out about how this guy was able to get this guy's translator and his six children and wife out of the country. And I think they might even make a movie out of it, which is cool. So finally, this guy gave up somebody on the inside. I contacted that guy on the inside. That guy got back to me and he said, your dude needs to move at this time and be here by this window in this location. I still have a picture of his finger pointing to what I would later learn is Abbey Gate. And he's like, there's going to be a tower there. There's going to be a tower with a crescent moon Turkish flag on it. And that's where he has to be at this hour. And then we'll give him a code word to get him through there. It was kind of cool. You know, that guy, my guy, Kareem, at that point, he'd mentally broken down because he had made numerous attempts to get through. And on the last attempt, the Taliban shot somebody to death right in front of him. And he had to crawl under a cab for cover and went home. So he had been not slept for days. So I was finally able to tell him, like, we've got a plan now. I need you to be smart. I need you to go to bed. He was able to sleep for the first time in days, he told me, and just knowing that we actually had like a real plan in play. And he eventually, he made it through six Taliban checkpoints. This guy got to Abbey Gate. After 23 hours of sitting on the floor, was ultimately brought through the gate and got out. At that point, you know, we had these three successes and I realize it's not just us. This is like this larger operation of many people in our shoes in this thing called Digital Dunkirk, which you could Google. It's this crazy, crazy thing where just like ordinary people like me in their basements are coordinating with all sorts of different characters trying to get them out of the country. But, you know, at this point, we had a safe house to put people in. We had this guy who could be a guide to show people where this gate was. We had communications methodologies to kind of, you know, sanitize us out of their phone and then reestablish communication. We had a couple people inside of the airfield that we could get in contact with. And so we just went to work taking house calls. And ultimately, the six of us processed like 18 people through, if you include an unborn fetus, a person. You know, we also did another translator who he was living in Colorado at the time, but it was his wife who had had like a head injury from shrapnel that hit her when she tried to get through on the first day. And we got to the point where we were able to like mobilize NDS agents to go retrieve people. And that's how we got her out. So it was kind of cool. It went on for 2 weeks before they just welded the gate shut. And, you know, the last C-17 took off and really at that point, I wasn't able to help a single other person after that. Kareem landed in Indiana. And then I made a business trip out of driving across the country to Indiana with a coworker of mine to pick him up, mainly just because we wanted to be able to write it off. But, you know, I had created a GoFundMe for him and my company put a lot of money into it. So I called this guy and said, you know, thanks for donating. And he said, well, when are you going to go get him? I'll come with you. I had a business deal. I was working in Indiana anyway. So it worked out. We picked Kareem up, embraced, you know, it was 8 a.m. I signed for him like a piece of serialized equipment from the State Department. We just got in the car and we're like, yo man, welcome to America. And hey, we just got to head into this meeting now. So just hang out while you wait for us. So this thing was in a nice building. There was, the bottom was a shopping plaza, and he was just kind of walking around, looking in the shop. I couldn't buy anything; he didn't have any money. We go up, we do this meeting for 4 hours, and the guy at the end of it, he's like, if you're from Connecticut and you're from New Jersey, like, what were you guys doing here? Why'd you say you were driving through the neighborhood? And so we decided to tell him the SparkNotes version of the story. And he's like, well, that's absolutely incredible. I want to meet him. So he comes downstairs. He shakes this guy's hand. And he just turns to me. He's like, we're going to go with you guys. We're buying this off. You know, it was cool. And then we took this guy out to Hooters. He had his first beer ever, you know.
Hooters, man.
Yeah, he couldn't believe places. It.
Yeah. How Marine yeah. Corps is that, dude? Thanks for
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
He saw like a woman jogging in like a sports bra. And he's like, oh, my God, I've never seen like the shoulders of a woman before. Which I knew, but my friend Jim, my coworker, is like, wait a minute, you've never seen him. Like, you've never seen that before? And he's like, no, how could I? I've never had like an arranged marriage for me. And he just looked at me, he's like, dude, we're going to lunch at Hooters, you know? So that's where we went. And then we went to Nashville. We were supposed to just drive home to Connecticut, but we decided to just drive south for four more hours wherever that is, Indianapolis. To Nashville, and we did it up there for a night. So he got a good welcoming. He arrived back in Newtown. They made a big deal out of it. They put him in the paper. He worked with me for a while, and he was a cashier at a butcher shop. And then it wasn't long before some surgeon came along and was like, "Do you want to be my assistant?" I was like, are you kidding me? This guy doesn't even know the difference between like 9 and 7 inch dome lids. But he lives down in like DC area now and works with a surgeon out of Bethesda. So, you know, that was a happy story. The reality is there's a lot of people we weren't able to get out of the country. You know, we helped a college professor, a woman who was all by herself, a Hazara woman who had been victimized by the Taliban. She works with me at this tech company now. So it's kind of cool to see like where some of these, you know, a lot of them are really amazing for the job market. So, yeah,
man, that's awesome. What a story, dude. I mean,
yeah,
you know, at the end of the day, it's like that's what a buddy of mine told me in Afghanistan. It's like, well, you know, we may lose this war, and we will. You know, this is in 2015. It's like we're gonna lose this war. He's like, but at least you can say you've been here, you know, and you got to see it. And that's kind of the thing. It's like you participated in something that. I mean, who else participates in that, Chris? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I turned to my wife and I said, who'd have thought that the most important thing I would do in this whole war would be 8 years after I left the Marine Corps? And to me, I mean, that's true. Like, I don't really feel like I did anything meaningful until, like, the summer of last year. You know, with those five people working with me. So
I'm sure you did some meaningful stuff. I mean, it's just, that's just the way it works, man. That's just it all.
Yeah.
But you talk about that breakfast.
Doesn't mean it wasn't meaningful.
Yeah. And you talk about that breakfast with the guy. I mean, they knew it back then too. That was what, 2013 you said? 2012?
Yeah. That was the summer of 2013. Yep.
Yeah, yeah, that's just a small microcosm of the grand thing, I think, that we're all kind of coming to terms with.
Yeah.
I just imagine each one of my PowerPoints changed at least one person's life, you know?
So. Look, dude, I've been there with them. I mean, I did two tours of PowerPoints, you know?
Heck yeah.
Really, the third tour was the cool one that I talk about, but I did two tours telling Prowler pilots, like, what the weather was going to be before they went and flew. So,
yeah, right. Yeah. You got to know that there were reports of an SA-7 in the area. Trust me, I was in aviation intelligence in the Army, so I know what you're talking about. I have to know, right? It's got to be down there somewhere.
Look, dude, some of the best guys I know are 0207s. So, you know, the air intel guy. I mean, honestly, it was a weird MOS where they're just like, we have no use for these guys. While we're fighting these two wars, and one of them's a mostly landlocked country and the other one's go completely landlocked country with no aviation threat whatsoever, you know? So like, I guess we're just going to make you guys be advisors, you know? And so, yeah.
None of those R-27s you studied after our OCS or anything coming in or anything. Yeah. So, all right, man. Zach, Stu, you got anything else? I'm just like blown away by these stories, man. That great stories, dude. What a cool life.
Yeah, this is amazing.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
This is so much better than anything we had planned.
What did you guys have planned?
I don't know. Boring history.
Yeah, we didn't give a shit about that. And the minute you started talking about like these stories,
nope,
like,
we'll do that one later on.
Helmand Province history anymore. I was like about to talk about like Little America in like the 1960s and the Helmand Argandab Valley, and like nobody gives a shit about that, dude.
Yeah. If you weren't here, we were just going to summarize Wikipedia articles again and pretend like we know what we're talking about. So it is what it is.
Little America. That's a book, isn't it? I don't think I read that book.
Yeah, it's good. But
that talks about the engineers that came in there and built the Kajaki Dam and whatnot, right?
1960s, yeah. Like this, yeah. Literally like a small town that was like had movie theaters and they would show movies and like people would walk around like it was like the modern like America, but like obviously the religious leaders in Helmand absolutely hated it, so it didn't really go.
Women had shoulders.
Women had shoulders out. No sports bra running. I mean, even the 60s, that was like a no-go, probably.
Yeah. It's crazy to think. Like, when you look at some of the pictures of Kabul City in, like, the 50s and 60s and compare it to even, like, while we were there in 2010, let's just say, it's pretty wild. And the culture clash is something that I just observed beforehand. You know, you want to talk about, like, you come have your translator who's been indoctrinated into that way of life for 28 years, you know, come live with you for 5 months. And you realize really quickly, like, smuggling this dude out of the country was just the beginning of the challenges. It was just the beginning of the challenges. I'll never forget, like, we were going to dinner. So this guy, I didn't even know there was a single Afghan that lived in Newtown, but this guy invited us over he was an Afghan. I mean, he moved here when he was like 6 months old, right? But he was very culturally attuned, I would say. For somebody who moved here when he was 6 months old, I mean, he had he married into another Afghan family and, you know, his wife wore hijab. And so he had us over for dinner. And Kareem's like wanting to invite more people over, and my wife goes, "Well, Kareem, you know, maybe they didn't make enough food for more people." And he goes, "No, this is the woman's job to make sure that there'll be enough food for whoever we want to bring." And you know, like my wife is like, you know, she's like an HR person. She's HR director at the time. She works at Yale now. Like she's a real career woman, you know. She doesn't take no gruff, you know, just that kind of stuff. You know, she didn't want to do the advisor thing where you just kind of brush it off and you try not to make these huge, you know, monumental social changes in somebody's life. You know, she takes the approach of like, no, let's deal with this head on, you know? So there's just like a lot of culture clash. That's all I'm going to say is just tons of it, you know, in every aspect, in every day, you know, a friend who is leaving her husband because she found like another man, you know, like that's just unthinkable. Like, Chris, what's going on with, you know, this uncle of yours? Oh, well, you know, she's decided that she wants to divorce him. She's in love with somebody else now. And that's how it goes. So he's going to give half of everything he owns to her. And she's going to go live with that man, you know, and like, it's just, this is this mind, some of this stuff is just absolutely mind boggling. Or even when we picked him up, just going underneath an overpass in Indiana, you know, he's like, oh my God, you have bridges for like to not have intersections. And I was like, dude, this is going to be a long car ride. Like, of course, by the time he got to Manhattan, his brain had exploded. So, you know. We took him to his first strip club and like he just slowly looked at me and he goes,
"It has to go back to the pure Marine Corps here." Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he looks at me and just goes, "This is the greatest country in the entire world." You know?
Wow.
Twice in your time.
my coworker Jim's just like, yeah, we do this every day. You know, it was like the first day.
Wow. That's awesome, man. What a yeah. story.
Yeah.
So Chris, you know, I mean, we're kind of, I think we're kind of winded down at this point. As always, we love to give our guests the last word. Anything that you want to say, anything you want to promote, no matter how extreme it is, you know, morally or politically, we're happy for you to say whatever you want. Well, I'm just kidding. Just take this time, go ahead and get the last word in.
No, guys, I appreciate you having me on. You know, I really appreciate it. I think everything that I've wanted to say, you've let me say. So thank you, everybody, for your time and for inviting me out here. This has been really cool.
For our listeners, if you're ever in the Connecticut area and you need a strip club recommendation.
No, I don't even know. I've never been to a Connecticut strip club. I've lived here my whole life. Never done it. Only right. Nashville. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, it's all right. I live in Knoxville. So next time you're in Nashville, hit me up. We'll go
hang out. Absolutely do it. Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. Have a good night.